the story of Korach, the rebellion of Korach, from those pneumatic parshios in the Chumash, what drove Korach, what drove the people that were with him. Chumash begins, beginning of Parshas Korach. Korach, son of Yitzhar, son of Kahat, son of Levi, separated himself with Datan and Aviram, sons of Eliav, and Om, son of Peled, the offspring of Reuven. They stood before Moshe with 250 men from the children of Israel, leaders of the assembly, those summoned for meeting, men of renown, and they said, the whole entire people are holy. Why have you exalted yourself above the congregation of Hashem? And the Mefarshim point out what was it that motivated Korach to rebel, why Dafka specifically now. We understand that Korach used many different mediums in order to get the people to rebel. He had a personal agenda, perhaps, that he was upset that his younger cousin became the head of the tribe. He wanted to be the Kohen Gadol. The 250 people also felt they perhaps had a chance to be it. Why should it all be one family? Let it go back to the Bechor, to the firstborn. There were a lot of different aspects that were involved in this rebellion. I'd like to focus it on today. We've spoken for years about different aspects. I'd like to focus on an aspect we spoke about before from a completely different perspective, and that's the personality of Om ben Peled. We find him at the beginning in our Pasuk that Korach took Datan Aviram and Om ben Peled, and later on in the Parsha we see Datan Aviram playing a major role. They stood Nitzavim upright against Moshe. They refused to go to him. We see them in a very major role in the Parsha, but Om ben Peled isn't mentioned in the rest of the Parsha. And as source number 3 points out, Ach Om ben Peled muskar kan ben Roshei Adat Korach ne'alam mikan ve'elach kilu balal to adama. It's as if the ground ate him up, and we know the ground didn't yet open up and eat anybody. L'chein chipsu chazal la'am ne'alam Om. Where did Om disappear to? And further, the question is, if Om, as we'll see in a moment, in fact did tshuva and wasn't part of the rebellion, then why even mention him in the first place? If it's not even Nogeav, he isn't even part of it, what's the significance? So the Medrash we've spoken about before when we focused in on the wife of Om ben Peled is the following Medrash. It's a Gemara in Sanhedrin. Rav said Om ben Peled was saved by his wife. She said to him, what difference is it to you whether Moshe, Korach, or anyone else is our leader? If this one is a teacher, then you are but a student. If the other is a teacher, you're still but a student. Om told her, what can I do? He took part in their plans and swore to join them. She says, I know the entire nation is holy, as it's written, for the entire nation is holy. Sit, and I will save you. She then gave him wine until he was intoxicated, put him to sleep inside their tent. And then what did she do? She set herself at the entrance to the tent, uncovered her hair. Whoever saw her went away, and that way the people of Om's conspiracy, of Korach's conspiracy, did not come and get Om, and that way his life was saved. So we also have to understand this medrash, what the imagery of being drunk, of going to sleep, of uncovering the hair, what is all of this about, also needs to be understood. If we answer our second question first, why is Om mentioned if indeed he wasn't part of the rebellion ultimately and he wasn't killed? So here the Eish Tamid Rav Druk in 4a notes the following. Chazal learn out on the names of the individual that Datan Shavar Dat El, that he went against the religion of God, Aviram, Shivera Tzmoma So Tshuva, he prevented himself from doing Tshuva, Va'on Shiyatshav Ba'aninut, that he sat in mourning, he sat in Tshuva his whole life, Ben Pelet, Shenasulo Plaot, wondrous things, Pelet, Plaot, wondrous things were done to him that he was saved. Ben Reuven, the son of Reuven, Ben Shira'ah Vehevin, the child of the one Reuven who saw and understood that this was not the correct approach. Im came it by Ami Divere Gemara, Kion Ben Peled Lo Zobel Vachelo Chataima, and Besofo Tavar Ela Afasa Tshuva, the Asav Marinuro Kachayayma, and Beitza Trila. So if we see that Om not only didn't join them, but sat in mourning and did tshuva, so then why is he mentioned? So there are two answers I'd like to suggest just very briefly, and then really take this on a completely different track, this whole personality of Om. The Gemara says that machshava ra in a Kodesh Baruch Hu mitzarfa lemaisa. If you have a negative thought, it's not counted as if you've done it. Which the opposite is true. If you have a good thought, then it is mitzarfa lemaisa. Right? I have a thought to visit somebody, bikur cholim. I wasn't able to do it. I still get credit for having this positive thought. If I have a thought, let's say, to steal from somebody, and I don't steal, so it's not accounted for that I stole, or I was going to speak Lashon Hara and I decided against it, I don't get, you know, punished for the thought. There's only one exception. And that exception is if your machshava itself, if your thought itself is the machshava that goes against the Kadosh Baruch Hu. If your machshava, if your thought is that of apikorsut, of denial of God, so in that realm, the thought itself is an action. And therefore, you are credited for having this thought. Likewise, he goes on to explain that one who argues against one's Rebbe is as if you argue against the Shechina, as if you argue against Hashem himself. And therefore, in our case, that Korach and his followers were arguing against Moshe Rabbeinu, and the legitimacy of Moshe Rabbeinu was as if they were arguing against Kivyachol Kodesh Baruch Hu himself, and therefore the machshava is mitzaref lemaisa, and therefore, albeit that Own did tshuva, but he is held accountable for this original thought, and for having even thought that he could rebel against Moshe Rabbeinu, and hence, he's mentioned in the parsha, albeit he's not killed, but the mention of it shows you the seriousness of not having thoughts of apikorsut, not having thoughts of denying God or denying the great Torah leaders that Hashem puts in this world. The second answer that Shemin HaTov gives is he notes that although he did tshuva, but he didn't reach the level of Kabbalah Lahaba, v'lasot tshuva be'emet. The idea of Own is he sat ba'aninot, he sat in mourning. Unlike B'nai Korach, who are praised, l'mnatzeach li'B'nai Korach mismor, we look at them very highly because they mamish the tshuva, Own ben Pelet is almost in that middle stage. He retracted from what he did, he felt bad for what he did, but the full process of tshuva, al-kabbalah lahaba, of how to act in the future, that stage was missing, and hence he's noted, but again, on a whole different level of not being punished on the same level because he's not accountable, but to note that the level of Own is still not the highest level of tshuva that there is to reach, and hence he's mentioned in our parsha. So let's try to understand Own. And the question that the Shari Chaim asks, and I think this is the question that's going to lead us today, is Ech lo alal dat Own ben Pelet svarab shuta kol kach shamra lo ishta. You know, his wife is telling him something very basic. He wins, you're going to be the servant. He wins, you're going to be the servant. Mimanav shach, you're not going to get a high position anyway. Like, why bother? Now, that is, you know, pretty basic. Like, what is, and they describe Own ben Pelet's wife as Chochmas Nashim Bansa Beisa. This is the wisdom of a woman who builds her house. Is this such a gewaltic idea that Own couldn't figure this out himself? Like, how come Own didn't say, gee, you know, I can't get a position either way. Why bother getting involved? What was it that Own wasn't able to see clearly that Mrs. Own was able to give him straight on this type of advice? What I'd like to try to do today is a little bit different than what we normally do, and I think that's adds spice to life, so to speak, is to look at Own ben Pelet not only as an individual, which clearly he is, and that will clearly be a part of our discussion, but to look at Own ben Pelet as a prototype, and that he forms for us a prototype of our lives. Own is an individual of aminut, of mourning, of somebody who's in a state of struggle, somebody who's in a state of, I don't know quite what to do. Ben Pelet, he has the higher self, he's the son of the higher self, is the plos, is the wondrous part of himself, the part that he knows what is good and what is truthful. And the personality of Own ben Pelet really becomes for us a mirror of our own selves and our own struggle in life. And what I'd like to try to look at is what were some of the things that drew Own ben Pelet into this sichsuch, into this quarrel, when it wasn't directly about him, what were some of the things that enabled him to fall into the trap, which is a reflection of what are some of the things that enable us to fall into our Yetzer Hara and look at Own as his prototype, and then be able to then step back and look at Mrs. Own, the Ishto Kegufo, the wife is like the husband, as his Ezer Kenegdo, as his counterpart, as the higher level, the one who did plows for him, the one who did the miraculous for him, the one who saved him, and to see what is that part of us that can save us from the downfall of the Own. In what way can we learn from Mrs. Own Ben Pellet how we can save ourselves like she saved Own? So it's going to be more of a study of the Yetzer Hara and the Yetzer Tov in the personality of Own and Mrs. Own. What was it that drew Own into the argument? The answer is we don't know. But we do have a couple of insights from Chazal of what was his agenda. Datan Aviram clearly had an agenda we're not speaking about. Korach had his agenda. What was Own Ben Pellet's agenda, right? So one is the idea Rav Friedlander brings in his essays on Sefer Bamidbar, where he talks about the koach of leitzonos, the koach of mockery. We've spoken about this idea before. However, I think it's an idea that we need to emphasize over and over again because I don't think we're aware of how much it infiltrates our lives. And Rav Chaim Friedlander Zatzal notes this very quickly. He says, Koach hashba'ah haya aidei leitzonos. Obviously, what Korach was saying made no sense. But when you present it in a way of mockery and derision, it has the ability to draw people. And there's a famous medrash which Chazal bring down. I'll just quote ideas of the medrash. It's very well known in 7 and 8. Korach gathered the people together and said to them, you know, let me tell you a story. It's a story about Almana, a widow, who had two daughters, and she had a field. She came to plow her field. Moshe said, hold on. You can't put a shor and a chamor together. She came to plant, and he says, you know what? You can't plant two different types of seeds together. Then she finally gets food from her field. Moshe Rabbeinu comes and says, hold on a second. You have to give this amount to the poor, the leket, the shikha, the peah. Then comes along the kohen. Well, hold on a second. I need truma, then the levi. I need truma's meister. And all this is taken from her. So she says, you know what? Okay, field isn't a good idea. She sells the field and she buys sheep. She comes to shear the sheep. Hold on a second. You have to give us the oldest of the sheep. And then the a portion of the shearing of the sheep. And the story goes on and on how everything this poor widow is trying to do, the Torah comes and takes away basically all of her wealth in order to feed the Kohanim, the priests. Now, obviously, the story is dimyoni l'chalutim, is made up. There was no field in the Midbar. They weren't able to do half of these mitzvos. Rather, what it's trying to say is, zeh kocha, double underline in A, shel haleitzanu shima benet ma'adam lerot et ha'met ha'mitzvutit, v'lamin gamal dream ha'dimyoni l'chalutim. Leitzanus, when you start making fun of this, can you imagine this religion? This religion, you know, this poor widow is trying to be able to support her and her children, and what happens? These priests come along and take everything she owns, and whether it's in the field, whether it's in the animals, I mean, can you imagine such a religion? And when you build up such a case in such a mocking tone, people are like, wow, I never thought about that. Yeah, this really isn't fair. And slowly but surely, it impacts people. That's the power of leitzanos. Shemivatli ma'adam says Mesulas Yesharim the Ramchal et kolach hazehirus. You stop being able to think clearly. Ki nei aschok u'me'abed et leiv ha'adam shekvar ein hatam ve'ediyah moshelet bo. You don't even think any clearly that you stop to say, well, hold on a second. There's no field here. There's plenty more for her. Like, you know, let's get a perspective here. And the imagery that he uses is mamish the imagery that helps us explain the medrash, right? Remember, going back to the medrash of Own Ben Pellet, she gave him to drink, him intoxicated, drunk, and he went to sleep. The state of being drunk is for us a model of what happens when you are in a state of late sunus. When you're in a state of late sunus, the arrow at 9, havarehu kishikor, you become like a drunk, o shote, a simpleton, asher eif sharla, tate lehem aramau lanigam, you can't allow them to make choices. Ki enam mekablim hanaga, because you can't even talk to them anything of rationalization, because they're in a state of non-functioning. By putting him in this state, she's basically teaching us a lesson that when you are affected by Lake Sunos, when you're affected by mockery and scoffing, you reach this level where you're not thinking clearly. Umosif lahasbira korcha Lake Sunos v'kokach lama l'fi intent shekemo shekol mitzius hazahirus talui b'siman halev al davar ken kol atzmo shal schok eino el meisir halev min ha-machshavot ha-yesharot v'ayiniyot. What does drunkenness do? It takes you from being able to think clearly. That's what Leitzanos does. This is what mockery does. And therefore, you're not able to take a look at the situation in an objective way. And that's why we are told, Ubimoshav in 12, Leitzim lo yashav. Don't sit in a Moshav Leitzim, in a place of scoffers. Because even the place itself, notes Rav Dessler, impacts a person. It's like the walls itself. It's screaming out this mockery. It's screaming out all of this late sonos. And this has an impact on us and all those around us. Rabosai, what was the power of Korach? Why was Ohn drawn into this when he didn't have a personal vendetta necessarily? The answer is, he was in a state of stupor. He was taken in by this mockery in the late sonos, like a slippery slope where he wasn't able to think clearly. Rabosai, this is something that we need to be aware of. One of the things that drives us away from Yiddishkeit, drives us away from acting in an appropriate way, and one of the major things from stopping us from growing in our Torah and mitzvot, is this cynicism and mockery. How many times do you hear on a Shabbos table, lo aleinu, where the parents come home and what do they talk about the entire Shabbos lunch? Oh, and the rabbi spoke about this. And who is he to talk about this when you know what his own kid is? And you know, I know about him that. And when you hear these things, it just undermines the whole authority of the rabbi, the whole authority of the teacher. Oh, you see the way the teacher spells? The teacher does spell check these days, and they still don't know how to spell. When you make fun of, when you mock, then everything that teacher teaches is undermined. Rav Huttner, listen to your message, Rabbi Friend, quotes Rav Huttner in 13. Rav Huttner contends that the struggle against cynicism forms a paradigm of the epic battle between the Jewish people and Amalek. Amalek's attack on the Jewish people was far more than a military confrontation. The battle between Jewish people and Amalek centered on the very issue of cynicism. There's a powerful tendency in human nature, Rav Huttner writes, a veritable passion to denigrate, to mock, to tear down, to eliminate others. There's a tendency to take that which is noble and important and holy, and to find within it the little hair-like crack which can be used to bring the entire edifice tumbling down. It's a particularly virulent form of the Yetzer Hara. People have Yetzer Hara for money, for honor, for pleasure. They have all sorts of forbidden things. And there is a Yetzer Hara to destroy other people, to be cynical, to put other people down. The nation of Amalek personifies this tendency. They attack the people when we were at our highest, just to say, you think they're invincible? You think they're so great? It was not territorial. It was not political. It was not even ideological. It was cynical. I don't understand this Yetzer Hara. I mean, I understand why people want, you know, food. They want a good piece of steak. I understand why people want money. I understand why people want honor. Why would people want this? Notes here by Fran, continuing 14, perhaps it's because cynicism liberates. Perhaps it's because cynicism emancipates. If there's nothing worthy and important in this world, all free to do as we please. If there are no higher standards, we can go all wherever our fancy and our impulses take us. If the citadels of holiness can be ripped down, we're all pleased. We're all released from personal responsibility. This is what Amalek is all about. As Rav Lipner put it in his inimitable style, Amalek represents the koach ha-chilul, the power of desecration, and we have an opposite tendency, which Rav Huttner calls koach ha-hilul, the ability to praise. The battle lines are drawn, the koach ha-hilul versus the koach ha-hilul, the forces of sacrilege against the forces of reverence. Amalek against Israel. This is the battle, this is the struggle. And you know, my friends, he notes in the asterisks, there's a little bit of Amalek in each of us. And that's why we have an inclination to be cynical, to mock, and to destroy. We see this ourselves, my friends. You know, how many times do our kids come home and they tell us, you know, Ima, you have to check the following vegetable the following way, or whatever it is. And we roll our eyes and say, you really believe that? You mean to tell me you believe that there are little bugs flying in there? Like, what else are they going to tell you? And the next thing they're going to do is sell you the Brooklyn Bridge. And when we react that way, what we've taken is that, A, what the teacher has taught our child, and completely not only destroyed this, we've destroyed the ability for that teacher to impact our child, and for other teachers to impact our child, and B, we've taken basic halachas, and we've mocked them, we've made fun of them, and then where is anything that is holy left? Why do we do this? Because who wants to soak grapes three times in order to make sure that there are no bugs? Like, it's a pain in the neck. We don't need this. I look at the grape. It looks fine to me. Like, what I need to do with a microscope? But when I'm able to step back and I'm able to have this ability to say, wow, I never knew that before. That's so interesting. I live and learn. And I'm able to integrate. Then the message I'm giving is koach ha-hilul. Thank you. I praise you. I recognize you've taught me something new I didn't know, and now I'm able to add it to my repertoire. So this is the philosophical basis why people tend to be cynics. There's also very real psychological basis. Arrogance, egotism can easily engender a desire to put people down and the institutions they represent. After all, who do they think they are? They're not religious enough, learned enough, smart enough, rich enough, successful enough, and so the arrogant, the Balgaiva, will seek to put them in their place, and what more effective way is there than a good dose of cynicism? Rabosai, when we are able to face the fact that all of us have a little bit of the cynicism in us, and it comes out in very, very different ways, we'll be on the alert for it. And we'll be able to recognize that there's a little bit of that own in us, that drunkenness in us, that we are not able to see clearly. And it's a slippery slope. The way to counter it, notes Rabbi Frantum 16, this, I believe, is also the key to overcoming cynicism. We have to develop the habit of being positive instead of negative, of seeing the good instead of the bad. We have to raise our consciousness. We have to be on the lookout and squelch those almost involuntary little cynical remarks that escape from our mouths. Then little by little, we will form the habits of looking at the world in a positive light, and will be immeasurably enriched both by the increased happiness in our own life and by the profound joy of seeing our children blossom into the kind-hearted and enthusiastic people we want them to be. So idea number one of what would draw a person like Owen, and by extension using him as a prototype, us, into a slippery slope of sin, is the idea of leitzanos, the idea of mockery. And when you're caught in that world of mockery, it's very hard to extricate yourself. The second Sefer Yerov Hadaat in 17 notes, Kishadam nitpas la'idei ha-yetzahara, when a person is caught in the trenches of the Yetzahara, Kishadam nofel b'nisayon, when we fall in a challenge, Kashelo ma'ol la'tzil t'atzmo, it's very hard to save yourself. When desires overcome us, we're so immersed in those desires, we can't think straight. That person can turn into a totally different person. And all the wisdom and understanding we had that we can beat the Yetzara is gone. As if it was never was. As Vasilis Yesharim points out in 19, envy is likewise rooted in a lack of understanding and foolishness. For being envious does not achieve any gain for oneself, nor does it cause any loss to the one who is the object of envy. There's a type whose foolishness in this regard is so great that if he sees his neighbor in possession of a good thing, he broods, worries, and feels pain to the point he'll not even enjoy his own good things because of the pain of seeing that which his neighbor possesses. Korach was not satisfied with being a distinguished member of the exalted tribe of Levi. His uncontrolled envy caused him to become a real-life illustration of the well-known teaching. Rabbi Elazar Kafar said, jealousy, lust, and glory remove a man from this world. On this, the Birkas Mordechai Rav Avdrachi develops this, and he says, what was the greatness of Eshet On Ben Pelet? And he says, we learn 22, when a person has jealousy, when a person has any type of desire, we have to understand the makings, the mindset of what happens when we walk into this state. He's so immersed in this, he can't see straight. You don't even know how to judge things clearly. Everything is about desiring to get what you want. This is when a person has become, desires something so much, they're not thinking straight. You know, it's a maysa that's brought down in the Medrash of a man who used to get drunk. And when he would get drunk, the kids would throw rocks at him and spit at him and say these terrible things. And it pained his son a lot, the way they would be mocking and making fun of his father. And he didn't know what to do. One day he sees another drunk fellow who the kids are throwing stones at and making fun of. He says, this is my perfect opportunity. He takes his father, who at that moment was sober, and he says, Dad, I want you to see what happens when you're drunk. Come with me, and I want you to see what they're doing to this drunk guy who's lying on the ground. So the father comes, and he sees this drunk guy who the kids are throwing stones and they're making fun of him, etc. What does the father do? He bends down to the drunk guy and says, tell me, where did you get such great booze that you're so drunk? This is where it's at. That even when you're sober, your mind is on the wine. He wasn't looking at all the things that were happening around this drunk guy. He was looking at, wow, he's really drunk. I wish I could be as drunk as that. This is such an illustration. You know, we see this, my friends. If you ever been, if you, not you, Chas V'Shalom, if you ever seen a machloket, which they say is L'Shem Shamayim, oftentimes you have this in a community where one group will break off from another group and they'll start a shul, they'll start a school, they'll start another organization, whatever it is. And they're really L'Shem Shamayim, they're really, you know, so to speak, for the sake of heaven. And sometimes they really are. If it is, Matov Manayim. But if it's based on some type of jealousy, some type of negative impulsivity that leads them to this, you start seeing that people start really degrading the other side and degrading the personalities of their side and saying things that are really mean. And what? We lost focus here. I thought we're starting a shul and our school. We're not here to rip down people and their professions and their careers and. When a person gets so into something, they've lost clarity. And when you stop them and say, whoa, they're like, no, this is part of this, and it's only because they're this way, they're acting this way, and it makes no sense. And you look at them and you say, you're equally as drunk, even if you're sober. This is what the Birkas Mordechai is saying. Motzim et ha'adam min ha'olam 23, pshuto k'mashmo ha'chutza. When you're so caught up in your honor, and you're so caught up in your desire, and your lust, and your jealousy, you're not part of this world. Michutz l'chol miskeret, michutz l'yashros, michutz l'muskal pashut, you can't think straight. This is what it does to you. Only plos, only something miraculous can take you out of this state. And we have to realize that when we're caught up here, we're in another world. Lo od ba'olamcha, lo od b'chokhmatcha, b'yashrutcha, lo od. You're not in your world. You're not in your normal state. And we know that you're in a different dimension. This, the way he describes it in the bracket in 25, is ki shavui hincha, ba'ali shavui b'shevi mar shokhinatcha. We are imprisoned. And we are so in prison that we don't even know how to get out of this prison. Go to sleep. Going to sleep is one aspect of leaving the situation entirely and then waking up, and hopefully a new day, a new perspective is going to allow you to see things differently. So if we understand O as our prototype here of what draws a person if they don't really have an agenda, one answer is leitzanos, is mockery, and the other is when a person gets caught up in a machloket, whose focus is either kina taiver kavod. That's like the flag that they're waving. Even if you yourself don't have kina and taiva, but you are part of a group who has this. In this case, clearly the kina and kavod of Korach and the members, you get caught up in this, and you get caught up in their rhetoric. And you're unable to see clearly. So my friends, if all of us have a little bit of own in us, if all of us have a little bit of that part of us that can get so caught up in worlds that we can't think straight, and this answers our question, why didn't Owen just say, gee, Mimonashach, and either way, I'm not going to win, why bother? The answer is he couldn't. He couldn't say that because when you're so in it, you can't see clearly. When you're so in it, you don't have that seichel hayashar, that straight ability to look at a situation. So my friends, is there any hope for us? How do we extricate ourselves? The answer is to learn from Mrs. Owen. And again, albeit that Owen Ben Pellet's wife is a separate entity, we all either have people in our lives who can take on this role, and or there's a part of ourselves that we need to be able to understand her tactics and to be able to use with ourselves to extricate ourselves. And I'd like to share some of the way the Mefarshim understand Mrs. Owen Ben Pellet's tactics. We'll focus in on two. The first Rav Nevenzel points out, and he says, we notice in 26 that she doesn't say to her husband, huh? Korach is arguing against Moshe. One of the Yud-Gimel Midos that the Rambam speaks about, of Ikrei Amuna, okay, the Rambam wasn't alive then, but we understand, is that Moshe Rabbeinu is Moshe Emes or Taroso Emes. Like, Owen, are you feeling well? Like, why would you even think that you could argue against Moshe Rabbeinu? She doesn't say that. That would have been a very logical argument. Why isn't she arguing logic? What is she saying to them? It doesn't matter who wins. Korach can win, Moshe can win, you're still going to be a servant. What? Like, let's start with basics here. Why can't we just say, here's the reality. Reality is, don't argue against Moshe Rabbeinu. And this is the Chochmas Nashim Beita Beita. Why? The asterisk in 26. Shekevan shiadal ta'isha shadat korach poelet mikorach yetzarav lo mikorach hasecha. She understood that Korach's whole uprising had nothing to do with seichel, because none of these people would have been caught up in a seicheldik argument. It was all coming from a yetzer hara. Lo nitzta lo chiyach lebala shemoshe tzodek ki gam hu yada baseichel shemoshe tzodek. And therefore, since it's a non-intellectual argument, she doesn't argue intellectually. And that's why her chachma was lomar et hamo'il biyoter bota sha'a. She's speaking to her husband in a language that he can understand. Et hatana yechida. He wants some type in his mind of honor. What his mind is on is not who's right, but what honor am I going to get from this? Korach is feeding into this part of the people of being more, you know, honorable. So she speaks to that part of him and says, husband dear, you want more honor? I have a little secret to tell you. You'll be shining this one's shoes and you'll be shining that one's shoes. It's not going to make any difference. And that, no la yetzer, but safa shelo, being able to answer the yetzer in its language, gam lufi ma'avei ha'yetzara lo taviach murma. That is the way to be able to respond to the yetzer hara. And that's the chokhmah that Eshet Om Ben Pela teaches us. And you just take a practical example. Try and wake up in the morning. For some people, waking up in the morning is not a yetzer hara at all. They want to get out of bed as fast as possible. So for you, this is not a good example. But for those who like to enjoy the snooze button and the snooze button and the snooze button, just another 10 minutes. Oh, I just need a little bit more sleep. So the yetzer hara has you, but good, right? Oh, it's so comfortable. It's so cold outside. Oh, who wants to face another day? So what do you say? To say to the yetzer hara, okay, I have to get up and do avodas habayit. I know that. And the yetzer hara will say, you'll get to it. Not now. It's not going to help. However, if you say to the yetzer hara, that warm cup of coffee. Ooh, do I enjoy that cup of coffee? You say, wow, I enjoy being in bed, but there's another taiva I also have, the taiva of a coffee. Ah, you know what? For the coffee, I'm ready to get up, and I get up out of bed. Speak the language of the yetzer hara. Pleasure versus pleasure. Being able to speak its language will be able to get us out of literally that sleep and get us up to wake up and smell the coffee. And that's just a paradigm as well for life. You know, Rav Nebenzal points out, he says, you see a paradigm of this even earlier in Chumash. And he notes this in 28 and 29. We'll do it outside. Yaakov Avinu has a dream where Kadosh Baruch Hu says to him, you know what, you've been here long enough. There's a mitzvah of Kippur Av. There's a mitzvah of living in Eretz Yisrael. It's time to go back. Lavan is not a good influence on you, blah, blah, blah. He calls Rachel and Leah out to the fields. Now, Yaakov Avinu should have said to them, you know, the place to be is Eretz Yisrael. Hashem told me to go back there. We need to go back. That would have made logical sense. He doesn't say that. Instead, he turns to Rachel and Leah and he says, you know, the asterisk in 28, Re'e Anochi Apnei Avichem, I've seen your father's face, Ke'enenu Elai Kitmol Shoshon, he hasn't been treating me like he's treated me in the past. And, you know, I've been cheated by him. And, by the way, Velokeavi, Hayai Mati, and Hashem has blessed me and told me, go back home. Huh? Why didn't they just say, God told me, go back home? And equally confounding is their response. And they say in the bracket of 29, Vatomarnalo, Ha'olanu chelik v'nachala b'veit avinu? Do we have a portion in our father's house? Are we going to make money? This whole conversation is bizarre. If God says, go back, go back. And the answer is, you have to deal with people where they're at. And Yaakov Avinu understands that there's a great pool of inertia to stay where you are. So he deals with that level of inertia and says, is it really good to stay where we are? Are we really benefiting? And Rachel and Leah also understand that you have to, not that they're interested in money, of course not, but you have to answer the yetzer hara the same way. You know, you're right. We're really not going to get anything from here. So you know what? It's really not worth staying here. Let's follow Hashem and go back to Eretz Yisrael. And this is something very important for us to understand. Sometimes we think the best way to hit the yetzer hara is to talk to them in Yetzer Tov language. And for some people, it works. And for other people, it's like, I don't care about my Yetzer Tov. Like, that's not part of the picture here. Like, I'm too tired to do anything. It's very nice that Hashem tells me to daven. I'm just exhausted. But when I'm able to talk in these terms, well, if I daven, then I'm able to get what I need, and I know somebody who's sick who needs a shidduch, and then, you know, my davening may help. Ah, it's worth davening for the shidduch, for the parnasa, whatever it is, the refuah. Okay, now let me go daven. It may not be the highest level, but it's at least being honest with ourselves on the language that we need to use when we speak to our yetzer hara. And he says, this is how we have to understand that the yetzer hara is trying to get us, and we have to be able to talk to it in its language. That, my friends, is aspect number one. When we understand Own as a prototype of an individual who's drawn to sin, how do we respond to this? talk to the Tahara in its language. This is the way Om Ben Pelet's wife talks to him, not about Moshe, you're arguing against him. No, that's too secheldek for him. Talk to him in his language. Kavod, you're not going to get kavod. It's not worth it. Oh, I'm not going to get kavod, gee. Then we can hear it more easily. The second aspect, and this, I think, is really crucial, is what did Om Ben Pelet's wife have over Om? Why couldn't Om say this? 32. Om's wife, Manchester Rav, used very simple logic. Why get involved in a dispute of such magnitude when you stay to gain nothing? It would seem that Om should have realized this himself. That he did not is yet another proof of the Yetzer Hara's prowess in beclouding our thinking and preventing us from recognizing obvious truth. Om was in the fore of this grateful challenge. However, Om's wife was, on the other hand, free of such influences and had no difficulty perceiving that which was obvious. What's the other way of being able to save ourselves? Being able to step out and being able to have this clarity. As the Datshraga points out in Source 34, Gadlutah shel Om Ben Pelet haita bekach, her greatness was, in a time of bilbul hadat, of such confusion, and people are screaming and yelling, and there's revolt and rebellion, and everything is crazy, she's able to tafsa tanekudah hamitit, she's able to perceive what is the core, and be able to convince her husband of the truth. Adam yachol lasod lechashbonot gedolim biyoter, kasher hu sharui b'menuchas hanefesh, u'b'sha'ash hu shalei v'shakein. You know what you need in order to be able to do this? Quiet, peaceful mind. You have to be in a state of menuchas hanefesh. When you're in a state of bilbul hadat, when you're in a state of confusion, and all this is going on around you, you can't make this cheshbon ha-pashut. Tafkid ho-adam hu, shegam b'matzav shel bilbul v'chotzer menuchas ha-nefesh. The job of a person is, when they're in this state of lacking this clarity of vision, to stop for a minute, to take yourself out of this bilbul, v'lantech et ha-inyam b'tzlilut ha-dav v'lagiel ha-met. So the first suggestion we made, if in this state of confusion, talk the language that you'll understand in your state of drunkenness. In the second level, and these are not contradictory, it depends on the situation and depends on one's wiring, and that is, step out of the situation. That's again that imagery of going to sleep, even though it may not be physically, it's an imagery for us. Step away from what you're involved in and be able to think clearly. You know, I just had this week. A woman called me up about a chinuch banim, or in this case, it was a chinuch banos question, about her daughter told her half a truth. I mean, she told her the truth, but she didn't tell her the whole story. And this woman overreacted, and the child overreacted, and then there was like one tantrum after another. And the woman, after the kid went to school, called me up and said, "Whoa! This got, like, blown up way out of proportion. Like, what happened?" And so I asked her, "Okay, tell me, you know, the whole story." And she said, and this is Mamash Nakuda, that she was at some function, and her daughter kept on calling her, and kept on calling her, and kept on calling her, and it was, like, over one stupidity after another. Like, can I have this food over that food? And then, like, the sixth or seventh call within the hour, she asked her about this. The mother was just so frustrated, she didn't even ask further, didn't listen fully, and said, "Yeah, whatever, it's fine," and then realized that the daughter then took it to do whatever she wants. What was the ability for this girl, this 8-year-old, 9-year-old girl, to get at her mother? Was the mother was in a state of bilbul hadas. You know, when you get kept on getting calls from the same kid, you're like, "Okay, just do whatever you want." And that's natural. This is what happens to us as mothers when we get bombarded. Sometimes it's 8 or 9 calls from 8 or 9 different kids within 1 hour, right? Each kid 8 or 9 times, right? At that point, you should learn already to turn off your phone, but if you're not that smart, this is what happens. We have bilbul hadas. We're trying to focus it on the program. We're trying to deal with our kids. We're trying to deal with 100 things. We have a zillion things on our head, and we're not even paying attention. And then we get very excited, and we lose it. The Sefer we mentioned many years ago, the Menucha Principle, Shai Astro, he speaks about this idea, he calls it Pizur HaNefesh. He says, the Rabbi Bartanura, who wrote the definitive commentary on Mishnayos, introduces the concept of Pizur HaNefesh on his commentary in Bein Zayin, the Mishnah says, Marbe Nechasim, Marbe Daiga. The more we own, the more we worry. The Rav explains from Bartanura what this means. To some, it means worrying about securing our possessions against robbers who want to steal it from us. However, to a chassid, the loss of our ability to control our minds and thoughts, possessions represents a far greater threat. He cites a tale about a wealthy chassid who prays to Hashem, Hamakom tatzileni mi pizur hanefesh. Please save me from pizur hanefesh. People hearing his tefillah said, what is pizur hanefesh? His response is, when someone has possessions in many places and his mind is always wandering and wondering about them, the Rav explains that some people are concerned about losing their physical possessions. However, the chassid is concerned about losing control of his mind when his thoughts wander and he may no longer be in control of them the way he needs to be. Therefore, for us, pizur nefesh represents any unwanted and even desired thought or feeling that alienates us from the essence of our Torah self and our ability to appreciate Hashem's many gifts. Our goal is to regain control of this feeling and behavior so we come closer to our deeper selves. Pizur nefesh is neither a disorder nor an illness. It's a challenge that Hashem places in front of us to overcome its many expressions. And he says that this is what we would call chaos in our world. I'm thinking about this, I'm thinking about that, oh my gosh, I have to do this, oh no, that, and I've turned that off, oh. And we're all over the place. And particularly the world we live in today, 37 at the bottom, invites and entraps us in pizur hanefesh through its constant bombardment of distractions which invade our lives at a multiple of levels. It's a world that thrives economically and culturally on promoting pizur hanefesh, whether it's Twitter, whether it's Facebook, whether it's all these things, right? That the beep of a new message is coming. You're always like looking, well, who's... I see this in shiurim I give, that people have, you know, beep beeps going on. You're in the middle of it in 1 hour shiur. How much do you learn a week that you need to have these beep beeps going on? Just turn off your phone. We're so distracted. And then when you read the message, you have to respond to the message. And that makes you then have to talk to somebody else, which then makes you do something else. And then you remember, oh my gosh, I didn't do that. And before you know it, you're completely not in the shiur anymore, or whatever you're doing. You're all over the place. You're pizur hanefesh. You're halfway around the world. This is the challenge that we have. How do we overcome our Yetzirah? The answer is to be in a state of Menuchas HaNefesh. First, to be able to be honest with ourselves that I'm all over the place. To be honest with myself that my mind is in a zillion places. And when it's in a zillion places, like this example of this mother, I may not respond from my higher self. I may not respond in the calm way that this mother usually is, because I've had it. Menuchas HaNefesh, Ravi Tamar Schwartz, in one of the Da and Atzmacha, getting to know yourself, he speaks about a very beautiful imagery that we really can bring into life. He says, it's really about, Menuchas HaNefesh is about a vessel for receiving the inner light. And he gives the following example in 40, if a cup is filled with water to the brim, and then it's violently shaking. At best, only half of the contents will remain. If you want all the contents to remain, you must either not move it, or move it slowly and evenly. This is about us as well. You want to be a receptacle for divine light? You have to be careful how you move yourself, what you're shaking yourself up with. And he brings us that model, the Eliyahu HaNavi, who has a vision, 19th chapter, Perek Yotet Melachim Aleph, he has a vision of an earthquake and a fire and wind, and Hashem is not found in any of this. Where is Hashem found? In the cold Bama Daka, the quiet, subtle voice. And that's the inner calm we have to bring to our souls. Going back to Shai Astro's book in 41, at the core of our true selves, which Hashem has placed within each of us, the sense of Menuchas HaNefesh enables us to remain focused on everything that is essential and crucial in our lives. This includes Hashem, our own true nature, our life's mission. Menuchas HaNefesh allows us to experience a sense of security, trust, humility, hakaras hatov. In this state of being, we can study Torah, think clearly, make decisions, and participate in each part of life that's related to Hashem's world. And the reason is clear. The state of Menuchas HaNefesh is the lens through which we can live from our deeper selves. It's like looking at the star from a Hubble telescope or from a child's telescope. You're seeing two different worlds. Rabosai, if we could use a psychological model here. So often a person has, you know, so many different parts that are voices that are overtaking a person. And what we need to do is to be able to split off those different voices, to be able to realize that they are coming from different parts of self, and be able to see when I am responding, am I responding, again, using a psychological term, from a blended part, or am I responding from self? And that's the real core of Menuchas HaNefesh. The blended part of me is all these different voices that are saying, it has to do this now, it has to be done this way. And these are voices that are generally voices of the outside world that are putting different pressures on me. That's the world of Pizur HaNefesh. The core self, the core of who I am is the Menuchas HaNefesh. And when I respond from the core of me, I ask myself, is this what is best for me? Is this the best way to respond in this situation? And that is the godless of Own Ben Pellet's wife. What she's able to do, and this is the model again as a prototype for us, is to be able to step back and not be so consumed with the issue going on, and be able to ask myself, where is this coming from? So again, it's not easy, and that's why we mentioned the first level, speaking to the Eitz Hara on its level. If a person has worked on knowing themselves and being able to hear their voice in situations that are not in Pizur HaNefesh, when they're not in a state of Kina, Taiva, and Kavod, if a person is able to know and identify that voice, then it is easier, even when they are in those times, before reacting and responding, to ask oneself, where is this coming from? What is motivating me? Is this really the voice of self? And that's the work that we really need to practice. That's the idea. And again, the imagery of removing the hair, right? Taking off, and the hair is a very deep symbol in Yiddishkeit. It's being able to come to the core self. Who am I really? And when I'm in that state, then no one's going to come near me. Because when I'm in that state, I'm speaking from a place of self, a place of certainty, and a place of clarity. And that is the message that Own Ben Pellet's wife gives us. Just to share one final imagery, the Yalkut Yosef Lecha, Rav Bifus in 42, brings a gewaldic idea from the Saba of Kel. And he says, imagine, this is the asterisk in 42, this is on the two boys struggling in the womb, Yaakov and Esav. He says, imagine the following scenario. Imagine two people grow up and they're BFFs, otherwise known as best friends forever. And they do everything together, and they play together, and they hang out together, and they study together, and whatever they do together. So you go over to one of them and said, do you know who your best friend is? And they'll look at you like, duh, of course I know who my best friend is. Because I do everything with him. And you're able to obviously identify him. Ask the Saba of Kelm, how come it is that our Yetzer Hara does everything with us? He's there whether we invite him or not. He's hanging out with us whatever we do. How come we're not able to identify, and when we say, what prompted you to do this, we're not able to point to that Yetzer Hara. We're not able to really have a clear idea of who he is. Al came the dar chovatosha kol achad v'achad laroch chashbo mipam lupam livdok em asav. This is what's incumbent on us, to challenge ourselves, to look at ourselves, to ask ourselves, why did I do this? Maybe I should have done something different. Who directed me this way? Is this really coming from self, or is it coming from a part of me that really doesn't reflect self? And that's why, as a Kovat Sichos, Rav Achweigel Zatzal notes that the message that Mrs. Own Ben Pellet gives to Own Ben Pellet is, you are exactly in the place in this world where you need to be. Hashem gave you the kochos and effort to be where you are. Nobody can take something that doesn't belong to them. What she's telling him is this message. Know yourself. Know who you are. Know at Makir Makomo. Know your place. Because when a person is in self, right? Again, in psychology, it's an IFS model. It's the core. It's the Nefesh Elokim. When I know exactly who I am and what motivates me and where I should be in life. What Om Ben Pellet's wife is saying, own, get to know yourself. When you know yourself, you know exactly where you need to be in life. And then when you start up with this crazy rebellion, you know it's not you. You know you got sucked in either through Late Sun or through Mockery. You got sucked into a group who had this Kina Taiva cover where you were so drunk that you weren't able to see straight. I want you to know something. The drunkenness of Own is the model of his downfall. The sleeping is the response. Step out. The uncovering of the hair is the response. Get to the core of self. When you're acting from that place of Menuchas HaNefesh, the place that you're able to really identify who you are when you look in the mirror, when you're able to hear your voice and not the voice of your parents and the voice of your spouse or your children or your co-worker or your boss, but your voice, then you're able to respond and look the Yetzer Hara in the eye and say, this is not me. This is not becoming of me. The challenge, obviously, encountering the cunningness is to be able to have that clarity of vision. The challenge is to realize that the own is own Ben Pellet, that all of us are Ben Plos. We all have this wondrous part of us, this higher part of us. And this is the part that we need to daven for. We ask a Kodesh Baruch Hu when we ask for Chonin Ladam Das, so we ask for wisdom and understanding. Part of this Das is to get to know ourselves. Part of this Das is the Techo Keinu B'Sorosecha we daven for. Show me my portion in Torah. Show me with clarity what I'm supposed to be doing here in this world. Because when a person knows themselves and is in self, then Kina, Taiva, and Kavod, honor, desire, lust, won't take me out of my world because I am comfortable in the world that I'm in. I recognize the voices in this world, and then I live a life not of aninos, of mourning, of, oh, how could I, where was I, what prompted me, but a life of Ben Peles, Ben Plos, a life of wondrous. And that's the bracha I leave all of us with, that we should be able to take the model of Mrs. Om Ben Pellet and integrate it in ourselves to have the ability to answer the Yetzer Hara in the language it understands, to be able to have that clarity of vision, to be able to be on a level of core self, of Menuchas HaNefesh and not Pisur HaNefesh.